cycling podcast Femina in association with RAFA. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, RAFA exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. Happy New Year, Rose Manley.
Happy New Year, Richard.
Happy New Year, Orla Shinawi.
Happy New Year. Goodness, it feels like a long time ago already, doesn't it? Welcome to 2019.
Yeah, how's it been so far for you kids?
I can't remember it, actually. No, I think I've already been out on a shoot, so I feel like New Year seems like a long time ago now, but...
Orla, you're joining us today remotely. This is the first time we've done this on the Cycling Podcast.
I know.
Very common that we do this on the regular podcast, but I'm with Rose here in London and you are in our Amsterdam studio.
I'm in our Amsterdam bureau, yes, because I can barely move from the Amsterdam bureau. So, no travel for me this month.
I mean, you're actually having a baby tomorrow, aren't you?
I was saying before you recorded, I thought I was maybe having a baby last night. I had 3.5 hours of contractions. And one of my first thoughts beyond, oh, damn, I haven't washed my hair yet, was I'm going to have to email them the news roundup so they can do the podcast in the morning without me.
Well, it's good of you to squeeze this in before... That.
Don't mention squeeze.
Yeah.
Please.
But no, it's fantastic. You're hardly missing a beat here.
And
next month you'll join us and it'll be as if nothing
nothing's
happened. Anyway, good luck with that. Hope it all goes extremely well. This is our first cycling podcast Femina of 2019. And we've got more interviews this month. Last month was pretty much dedicated to Ashley Moulman-Passio, who's got her season underway in Australia. Not a great start for her. She fell ill. We'll talk a bit about the Tour Down Under, which has just finished Down Under. And we're going to hear a little bit from Abby Van Twisk, who's joining Trek Segafredo this year. We'll hear from Hannah Barnes, a very interesting interview I did with her in Girona about the life of a professional cyclist. And in the final part, Orla, we're going to hear from Iris Slappendel, the retired rider who is one of the driving forces behind the Cyclist Alliance, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. She's based nearby in Rotterdam, so I waddled off to the train station just before Christmas to go and meet her and had a really, really interesting chat with her, actually, about the work of the Cyclist Alliance and also for us to listen to later. I'm going to be collating different bits and pieces, but chatted to her as well about the dominance of Dutch women cycling and just where that's come from. She had some really interesting points to make, but also about her work at the moment.
Before we hear any of that, could we have this eagerly awaited news roundup?
Well, yes, since I've gone to such an effort, I might as well, eh? As you said, Richard, racing is underway with the Women's Tour Down Under, and Amanda Spratt of Mitchelton Scott won her third title in a row. So a good season opener for Mitchelton Scott, with our new signing Grace Brown taking stage three as well. That's after she won the Australian National Time Trial title the week before. A good start as well for brand new, eagerly anticipated Trek Segafredo, with them taking their first win in their first race, stage one of the Women's Tour Down Under, won by the Italian Letizia Paternoster. Then on the second stage, it was Spratt who took the win. Stage three was a Mitchelton Scott victory once again, taken by Grace Brown, as I said. Don't know if you missed this or saw it, but the race had been briefly neutralised with 10 kilometres to go after the riders were directed the wrong way. But they got there in the end. And then Australia's Chloe Hosking of Ali Cipollini sprinted to victory for the second year in a row on the final stage of the race, but it was Spratt who took the overall title. Some very brief other news. Megan Barker was announced as the 10th and final rider for the Drops team. We've got quite a bit of cyclocross action with national championships. Nikki Brammer won her fourth British national title. In Belgium, Sani Kant won her 10th consecutive title, phenomenally. Here in the Netherlands, we had Lucinda Brand winning the Dutch title after distancing Marianne Vos in the final lap. So she won for the second year in a row. And in France, Caroline Mani regained the French national title, winning for the fifth time. And just very quickly, some national road action from Down Under as well. Georgia Williams won her second time trial title in a row. You may remember that she doubled up with the time trial and the road race last year. She finished seventh in the end in the road race this year with the under 23 rider Georgia Christie taking the road title and, incidentally, the first four riders across the line in the New Zealand National Champs were under 23s. In Australia, Sarah Gigante made a big splash by winning the Australian National Championships 18 years old. Gigante is, and she beat Spratt and Roy into third, and Grace Brown, as I said, won the time trial. That is your early season news roundup.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thanks very much to Rafa for supporting the Cycling Podcast Femina and being our title sponsor again. And I must give a shout out to listener Hannah Nicklin, who you may remember led the inaugural Cycling Podcast Femina Rafa Women's 100 ride back in September. She also did the Rafa Festive 500 over the Christmas period, and she's now made a computer game, a Bitsy game, about her experiences riding and doing the 500 kilometres over that week. It's amazing. Check it out. You'll find it on her Twitter feed. Go to twitter.com/Hannah Nicklin, N-I-C-K-L-I-N. That's twitter.com/Hannah Nicklin. Have a go and tell us how you get on. Thanks, Hannah.
Now you're going to come in with everything else that I've missed.
Well, there hasn't been a lot to miss. I mean, there's quite a lot packed in there. You know, I don't follow the cyclocross that closely, but I was working on a feature recently for Cyclist magazine and spoke to Lucinda Brand, who had a great season on the road last year, Sunweb, and over the last couple of years has been stepping up her commitment to cyclocross. And she's had a really good season and will go to the World Championships, I think, as one of the favourites. But it's interesting, because I was speaking also to Nikki Bramier, who, as you mentioned, won the British title, and they've had a couple of ding-dong battles. But Bramier's really focusing full-time on cyclocross now, and she just said that the challenge of balancing road and cyclocross is sustainable for maybe a couple of years, and then you start to burn out. And I, you know, Lucinda Brand clearly loves it, and she talked about how she builds in periods of rest and breaks into both the road season and the cyclocross season. She won a round of the World Cup in the Czech Republic and then went off sightseeing in Prague the next day. So she tries to balance things well, but I wonder how sustainable that was. But, you know, very versatile rider. I think she was fourth in the Giro Rosa last year, and then to go on and ride as well as she's been doing in cyclocross, it's yeah, very versatile talent.
But you'd think that now, when people are starting to specialise even more, so the climbers becoming more specialist climbers, and Lucinda Brand is one of those top climbers, you'd think that she would be forced to make a decision now to, you know, start being, if she wants to win the Giro Rosa, then going doing altitude camps all the time, and if she wants to do cyclocross, just focusing on that. But it'll be interesting to see how it works out as she has been doing.
And there's something to be said about having fun with it as well. If she's enjoying it, which you do enjoy something when you're winning, it can give you that added momentum for a little bit. So she may not be able to do it for a number of years, but for now, if it's giving her a boost in, you know, what would be the off season, then, you know, why not?
And she's still quite new to it, so she's still improving, and I think that's fun. But the challenge will become, I guess, when that that, you know, improvement slows down or stops, and then, you know, whether she can carry on doing a full road season, a full winter season, let's see. But she may well win a world title, and then she's not going to have any regrets about that, I don't imagine.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, you know, think about Marianne Vos has been actually, we're talking about Lucinda Brand as if it's some kind of really rare thing to be doing cyclocross and road season and winning at both. But actually, Marianne Vos has been doing that.
But was that not part of her problem? I mean, why she burned out?
Burnt out and injuries.
She's again back very strong again this winter. So,
and she hasn't changed that situation either. She still does road and cross. So, yeah.
Well, we will cover the cyclocross a bit later on in the year, perhaps, once the World Championships have been and gone. But the road season, as you mentioned, Orla, underway. Not a World Tour event. The World Tour for the women doesn't actually kick off until March, the Strade Bianche, which is quite late, really. There are a few big events before then, but Tour Down Under, it wasn't a terrific field, was it? Not to take anything away from Amanda Spratt's win.
It's always quite Southern Hemisphere, though, isn't it? And you know, Amanda's won it for 3 years in a row now. She does dominate it. And the also-rans tend to be fairly heavily dominated by the Australians and Kiwis, I guess. It doesn't have the same quality of racing or riders, I guess, as the men's version because it doesn't have the same status. It doesn't also get the same amount of attention. You know, once the men's Tour Down Under starts and everybody sits up and takes notice, wow, this is it, the season's underway. The women's Tour Down Under tends to go a little bit under the radar. But, I mean, it's enjoyable racing to watch at this stage of the season when, as you say, the actual calendar doesn't really get started until March. I quite enjoy it.
Trek Segafredo went there with a pretty strong team and, as you said, won the first stage. Quite a surprise. Letizia Paternoster, who is 19 years old, has a great pedigree already on the track, especially. She's a world champion. And that was quite a surprise and a great sort of start for that team. But they had quite a strong team. Lisa Longo-Borghini was there as well. And perhaps, you know, over the 4 days, underperform, perhaps won't be too happy with their first race. I don't know.
I'm not sure they'll be that bothered though, will they? I mean, in your interview that we'll hear shortly with Abby Van Twiske, you talk about the team bonding and bringing all these big names together and how they're going to gel and how they're going to work out their positions on the roads and whatnot. It's not a top level race, so it's not absolutely necessary to win it. It's a relief, I would say, to get not only a win under their belts, but the very first win possible. I would say that they would be fairly relaxed about it, really, and making sure that they are bedding in as a team before the season proper gets underway. I don't think they would have expected to dominate, and I don't think anyone would have expected any of the riders that were down there to dominate either, given as well where the race falls in the calendar for the Australian and the Kiwis. You know, they're coming off the back of the national championship, so they're all peaking in a very different way to the Europeans.
I think also Trek Segafredo will take something from the fact that Paternoster won the first stage, because, you know, when they were doing all the rider announcements, they just seemed to have loads of huge riders, big names, and when they would have announced Paternoster, people wouldn't have thought. I mean, very talented rider, and was got bronze at the Junior World Champs in Bergen just a couple of years ago, so, you know, her progression is huge. But for her to get a win, you know, it just makes you think that even more riders on that team roster are winners at the top level. So, I mean, I think that's a very positive thing for them. I mean, that makes them an even bigger threat. You know, people might be all eyes on some of their big names, and then someone like Paternoster can still win. So that's a good thing for them.
She was a junior world champion points race and team pursuit in 2016. So, and a multiple medalist at European champs as well. Well, you mentioned that I spoke to Abby Van Twiske when I was in Girona recently, who has joined Trek Segafredo from Trek Drops, where she's been for a few years. And we followed Abby, I suppose, from the start of her career as a senior rider. So I spoke to her about her move and what she expects from 2019. How much of a wrench is it, though, to leave Drops, where you've really sort of grown and started out? You've grown with that team, and obviously have a good relationship with Bob, who runs the team, and I know they wish you well in moving on, but how difficult is that to leave that behind?
Yeah, really sad. Like, the last race, I was pretty emotional, because obviously I've been with Bob for 3 years, with Drops for 3 years, and then known Bob an extra year on that with the British team. And yeah, just they've helped me develop so much, and I've, as you say, grown up in that team, and like so many opportunities from them, which has allowed me to move on to Trek. And yeah, so very grateful and also sad, but lots of my teammates live here in Girona, so I still see them all the time and everything, and can train with them.
And when did you get a sense of the type of team that Trek were putting together? You know, they signed so many big names that they're clearly not just entering women's cycling to have a team. They want to build a team that's obviously going to win some of the biggest races, don't they?
Yeah, I think one of the first contact I had with them, they sort of said they want to go in at the top and do it properly. So I think then I knew, like, this is going to be a big deal. They want to rival Bowls and just make sure that the athletes only need to worry about racing and training, none of the other stuff. So they want a big, like, a good setup around them and very professional. So yeah, I think it was kind of as soon as I spoke to them. And then when all the names started coming out, I was like, wow, this is big. I was like, surrounded by hitters. So,
I mean, do you know Giorgia Brazzini? Have you had much contact with her when you've been racing?
I don't know her personally, but obviously I know her from races we've been in together and watched her before I was racing at that level as well. But yeah, I'm really excited to have her as a DS.
Two female DSs, so that seems to be quite an interesting decision that they've taken to, you know, launch a women's team and have it managed by women as well. Is that something that you're quite enthusiastic about?
Yeah, I think it would be really good. They've both been there and won some of the biggest races in the world, so having them direct us in races will definitely be motivational. And also they know like how it is in women's racing, because sometimes it can be a bit different from men's, even though it's the same races and sport. But yeah, it'll be really good.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Voice of Seb Piquet there reminds me to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina, well, it's a new sponsor for the Cycling Podcast Femina, Harry's Razors.
Richard, I know I've got a bit of distance here, geographically speaking, and it's a little bit pixelated, but you do look, from here, quite clean shaven.
Pixelated.
The word peachy comes
peachy,
to mind, doesn't it,
yeah. Peachy Moore.
Oh, thanks.
Like a newborn babe.
Yeah,
I better not. I better not put a picture of you next to my baby when it comes. I might get confused.
Rose is sitting next to me, so she can confirm.
I'm not. I can't even say it's next to you. It's literally about 15 centimetres from this beautifully
shaven. You do look really cute on the screen, by the way. Just squished together like that. You can reach out and stroke his face, Rose. Do it.
I will.
Do it for the listener.
Nice.
Very nice.
Ah,
very nice.
Have you considered, though? Have you considered? Because you're sort of shaved all over, have you considered sort of styling out a little bit of a Peter Sagan tash?
No, I have not.
Oh,
Orla.
As
you can probably tell, listener, one of us has to endorse the Harry's razor, and it falls upon me to do that. I do use the Harry's razor, and this I think demonstrates that a lot of our listeners are men. It's a very mixed audience, as indeed lots of women listen to the regular cycling podcast as well. So thanks very much to Harry's for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast Femina.
Yes, they have a special offer for Cycling Podcast Femina listeners. They're offering a trial set for £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling.
What do you get with your trial set, Rose?
Well, you get everything you need for a shave good as Richard Moore's.
A close, comfortable shave.
Everything you need to look like Richard.
What better endorsement could there
be
than that?
Don't let that put you off.
And you need the whole set you need the whole lot of the things to get such a soft and peachy face as Richard's. So it's a weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip, and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover, so you can take it wherever you like. Whenever you go off to interview people in far-flung countries, you got your travel blade cover. Take
don't
it
go anywhere
with you.
Without my Harry's set.
Well, there you go.
I've been a dedicated user for a year now. A reminder, you can support the Cycling Podcast Femina. Get your trial set delivered to you, including the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel, and the travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling. So as I said at the start, I saw Hannah Barnes recently in Girona in the flat that she shares there with Theo Gegenhart, the Team Sky rider. And she had a difficult season last year. She went straight from, well, she started the season off extremely well, having finished the previous season extremely well at the World Championships in Bergen. And everything looked good. And indeed her team, Canyon-SRAM, began last year very well and then sort of fizzled out a little bit as the season went on. But she went from the women's tour to the Giro Rosa and crashed there and broke her collarbone, which really punched a big hole in her year and made it a bit of a disappointing season for her. So she was recovered from that, back racing, and then ended the season on a bit of a high at the World Championships again, winning the team time trial with Canyon-SRAM, the last trade team time trial. So that was good, but she could reflect a little on a slightly disappointing season from a personal point of view, and had some very interesting things to say just about the life of being a professional cyclist and the comparison with the sort of support that Tao gets as a rider on Team Sky with what's available to some of the top women riders.
But I started by asking her about Annemiek van Vleuten, the Dutch woman who for much of the season seemed head and shoulders above most of her rivals.
Yeah, I think she's kind of taken it to the next level. She'll go to a race and yeah, she's there to win it. And you can tell that she spent a lot of time at altitude this year and she puts a lot of heart, soul, money and time into it. And I think that's the way that it's going for us. It's going to be a lot more serious and we're going to have to commit and dedicate a lot more.
That's interesting. Is that because that's completely commonplace in men's cycling now, yeah. Having not been 10 years ago, that all the riders are spending a lot of time at altitude, more and more. Does that make Van Vleuten quite unusual in the women's peloton that she's prepared to do that?
I'm not. I think for some riders, it's probably they can't do it money-wise. Like you can't afford to spend 3 weeks to a month on top of Tidy in Tenerife. It's just the money side of it, I think. Mm. For me, it's lucky because a lot of the time I'll go up there with Tao and got like our own little training camp up in the mountains, which is nice. Or you kind of, if you're doing Tour of California, you can do a bit of time at Tahoe or Park City or something. So I think that's good. But yeah, I think that probably money-wise is holding people back. And a lot of riders have to have a job or so can't really do that. But I think definitely next year and the next few years is going to be a big increase of that kind of.
Where do you go? Do you go to Andorra much?
So we spend, well, most every year we go to Park City in Utah before California, and then we've done Font Romeu and Andorra as well. So gone to quite a few places actually, which
and
is
do you
quite
feel
nice.
The benefits from that when you do it?
So for me, training's all right. I struggle a bit, and then probably the first 10 days I feel really flat, and then slowly. I think that was why Bergen was such, because I'd spent, not that I enjoyed it, but a week on top of Stelvio, and I think that just gave me that extra bit at the end of the season.
Why do you say you didn't enjoy it?
It's just too high, and when you're climbing Stelvio every day after training, it's just you just don't recover much there at all. It was just a bit too much for me. But,
and do you sleep okay at that sort of altitude? Do you find that okay?
Yeah, for me, it's I have some crazy dreams when I'm at altitude. But no, I'm getting used to it. I mean, I try and do blocks of it because I know that it sets me up quite well for races that are 3 weeks to a month after.
It does seem, and this is men's cycling, but obviously it's happening women's cycling as well, that it's getting more and more of an extreme sport in terms of the lifestyle that you're required to live and the demands. Yeah. And the sort of self-imposed punishment. It's gone from being a sport where, you know, the training can be a lot of fun and in groups and so on, to being really where the riders who are enjoying the most success, it seems, are really living quite extreme lives.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is a full-time job now. It's not just the training that you have to do well. It's the eating, the sleeping, I went to go and watch the Vuelta for the last 3 days and you do feel it when you're having to do your training in the morning and then drive up to Andorra or whatever and go and watch a race and stand on the mountainside. It's just something that you have to really be careful. I mean, we'd park the car and everyone would walk off and I'd be like, I'll watch it from here just so I don't have to walk as far. Yeah, it's just stuff like that or, this afternoon go to the beach or something. But it's just, you just don't want to affect the next 3 or 4 days.
The balance there of, you're there obviously to support Tao.
Yeah,
but you've also got to train, and I saw you on your bike one day in kit. So you were trying to do two things there, weren't you? And that's where it gets really difficult.
Yeah. I mean, for me, there was a lot of riders that went to Madrid, and I really wanted to go to Madrid and then just like spend that night in Madrid and kind of just
enjoy the party.
Myself a bit. Yeah, yeah, and just but I was like, I can't do that. I've got Worlds in a week, and for me, that's way more important than watching a peloton race up and down a street in Madrid. So
do you find that quite difficult, that getting that balance right between
wanting
to have a life and obviously do as well as you can in your career?
For me, I find it hard. I'm finding it a little bit harder each season, I guess, just because, I mean, Tao's doing so well and it's nice to follow him and be part of it, but for me it's also my career as well, so we're really good at balancing it and helping each other out. And yeah, it's quite nice.
And Tao is very, and always has been, very supportive of your career as well,
yeah.
Isn't he?
I mean, yeah, he's He's really supportive. I mean, he's the really, really good example of someone that just lives and breathes cycling and does everything he can for his career. And yeah, it's really, to be around that is something that's helped me a lot.
If you look at the position he's in and the team that's around him, the thing he's part of, you're part of a good team as well, but is there part of you that's envious of the support that's available to someone like him?
Yeah, I mean, it's knowing women's cycling really well and also now knowing the insides of men's cycling. I know Sky's the best men's team in the peloton, so it's a team that you shouldn't really compare your women's cycling to, but yeah, when you hear of what, just the support that he gets and the help, it's quite amazing, really. I mean, there's a reason that they are the best team and they perform so well. And I mean, I can never complain about our team, the equipment we have, the support, the staff, they're really great. But there's definitely, you can see how it can be as well.
Where do you stand on this argument, this debate about the courses? There's been some really interesting, thought-provoking contributions to this, because people's initial reaction to, say, the Tokyo course not being as hard as the men's road race for the women, and also in Innsbruck without the final really super steep climb up to the finish, a lot of people, maybe not so much riders, but people complain about that inequality. And yet we hear from some riders as well that they want courses that suit more than just a pure climber and not just these three or four riders who could target that. And I guess you're one of these riders who, you know, you might look at the Tokyo course, for example, and think that could be one that suits me.
Yeah, I mean, so I was at the Vuelta on Saturday and they had that 100k stage with, 3,000 metres of climbing, 3.5 that. And two came past, and then 30 seconds later, Yatesy came past, and then about 2 minutes later, Valverde came past, and then like 5 minutes later, 10 riders came past, and then we were stood on the side of the road for 40 minutes. And yeah, it's a good race, but there was three or four people that could win that stage. And I think it's the same for Tokyo. I mean, looking at that course, well, at least half the peloton could win that race. And I think that's really good for us. It means the race will be exciting. People want to watch it. And I think that's what we need. I mean, this year at the Giro, going up the Zonkalan, it was great for us to be able to do that, especially the men doing that this year as well. But it wasn't really needed. And the time trial was a 16-kilometre climb. And you just think that that's just kind of limiting what can happen in the race and who can win. I mean,
well, I was going to ask you just about living here in Girona, because I've never spent time here really. And, you know, you wander around and you see so many professional bike riders in kit or out of kit. Do you like that? Do you enjoy being surrounded by that? Because there's quite a scene here in Girona.
No, I don't really enjoy it. You go to a race and you race, you're with the team, and I want to come home to home. But actually, I don't actually see that many. I think because I'm not someone that will go to a cafe lots and...
Well, you don't drink coffee.
No, I know. Yeah. No one can understand
terrible
that.
Terrible admission for
cyclists. Yeah,
cyclists.
I know. But yeah, it's just there's people here that I love to see, and as soon as we're in town, I'll just be like, I don't want to come for dinner or something. But yeah, for me, when you're home, you just want to sit on the sofa and relax a bit. And you're constantly always eating out at hotels or at buffets. So when I'm home, it's home-cooked meals that I quite enjoy. So
I get the impression you don't want your whole world to revolve around cycling.
No. I mean, yesterday I went for a really nice farewell dinner to Dan Craven and Colin Ahart, who've been really good friends to me here. And we went way into the mountains, and it was so nice because there was very little talk of cycling. It was more about the future and, yeah, their move and just everything. That was just really nice. Yeah, it's just cycling. You really don't want it to just completely take over your life, because you'll go mad otherwise.
What other things do you enjoy? I mean, how do you get away from it?
Do you know, I like to do a little cooking, or I like to read. I've just started kind of looking into what I might do after it and after cycling, and do some research on that and open some books. And yeah, just, I don't know, people ask me that a lot, and I just kind of just being at home, really. It's just nice for me.
I guess you would reflect on this season, apart from the early success, as a bit disappointing, would you?
I think so. I mean, finishing last year how I did, and I mean, I had last year the women's tour, the podium finish, and then the stage win in Giro and Bergen, and that year to me was really something that I was hoping to be able to improve on that. And I don't know, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why it wasn't able to. And yeah, I'll spend this winter working hard to try and correct it and go into next year.
You know in cycling how Teo at the Vuelta, perhaps, you know, he's a bit disappointed having ridden so well earlier in the year that you don't always make a linear progress. That, do you help each other in that respect when there are little setbacks or little disappointments? Do you sort of help each other? And does example of the other one help you as well to see that, you know, you can take a little setback but then take a bigger step forward?
Yeah, I mean, it is hard because, I mean, say I'm having my training's going really well, I'm racing really well, and then it's not going as well. But this year it's been the other way around. Teo's been going really well and I'm not so great. And yeah, it's nice just to, for me, I just have to remember that cycling is not, it's not everything, and you can do everything you can and sometimes it doesn't work out. I mean, I was starting to just feel quite good at the Giro, and then you crash and there's nothing you can do about that. It's just, you just got to focus on getting better. And I think for me, that time off was good, just mentally and physically as well. So yeah, I'm just looking forward to the next few weeks when I can, just get stuck in again and have a good time.
Hannah always gives such great insight, doesn't she? And she gives such considered opinions on things. I find her really interesting talking about the debate of late around the women's parkour and whether it's tough enough, whether it needs to be tougher, whether it needs to mirror the men's racing more. And it was interesting to hear her saying that she thinks it's about right, really, because I always think whenever race courses are announced, and we've had this debate ourselves a lot on the Cycling Podcast Femina, there is a gut instinct and an instinctive reaction among some quarters to complain immediately if the climbing in particular doesn't exactly mirror the men's racing. And, you know, we often hear from inside the peloton that actually the women themselves don't think they need that. They don't need it to make it, well, they don't need it to make it a good race, but also that it could be detrimental to the racing. I mean, we had this discussion at the World Championships this year. If the women's race had mirrored the men's race, I just don't think, I mean, as it was killed off with 30 kilometres to go anyway. Would it have changed things if they had to wait on the final climb? Possibly, but we just don't have the strength and depth in women's racing necessarily for the same kinds of routes that we've got in the men's. And that doesn't mean that it's not good enough. It just means, you know, you've got to create a sport that caters for and showcases the best of what's on offer at the minute.
Yeah, I mean, I think with the parkour argument, I think that it should be the same type of rider that wins the women's race as wins the men's race. And I think a lot of the time in the women's races, they're not quite. So I always think about like the Tour of Flanders. And we've had a few years where we've had so many people coming to the line at the same time, like a diminished pack coming to the line, etc. You never see that in the men's race because it's difficult enough that it's always kind of one person coming to the line or, you know, a two-up sprint. So in that way, I think that we do need to keep that balance that it has to be the same type of rider.
So you think Flanders should be more select? The women's
Flanders
should be harder?
I mean, obviously it changes year to year. It changes on all these things, obviously depend on how people decide to tackle the race and what tactics they use and which riders are there. But I think with when Corinne Rivera, not to take anything away from Corinne, of course, but when she won, I mean, there was a huge amount of riders coming into that long finishing straight. And then it was just a sprint like you might get at Gent-Wevelgem, say. And then for me, that kind of lost the character of what it is to win Flanders and what it is, what the Tour of Flanders represents when it's a race that finishes with that many riders coming to the line at the same
time. It's a good point. It's a good point. And what I hadn't really thought before, because a lot of the other races, think Strade Bianche and, you know, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the women's races tend to be very similar races to the men's, and the same, as you say, the same type of rider wins. I hadn't really, but you're right, with Flanders, the women's race does appear to be quite a different type of race.
And I think they have changed it since, haven't they? Because they changed it, now it goes through Gerritsbergen, and so the race has changed since those days, but I still think it's something that needs to be monitored a bit more across the board, across the calendar, instead of just these marquee events that we mention all the time.
Yeah, and I think monitoring it is exactly the right way to describe it and exactly the right action to take, really. That they've constantly got to be thinking about it, you know, and not just women's courses being an afterthought. But by the same token, while some races should maybe be harder, like Flanders, that doesn't mean that they all need to be, you know, and it has to be on the merit of the individual race. But I think that's a perfectly valid point, that if the same type of rider is winning both, you've probably got the mixture fairly well balanced. But yeah, I just thought it was interesting that she thought that it's not necessarily every single race has to be harder, because otherwise we're not earning our stripes the same way as the men, and we can take these tougher climbs, so why not bring them on? That actually it has to be balanced out for the breadth and depth of the women's peloton as it stands on any given year, which obviously changes.
She was very refreshingly honest. I don't know what you guys thought, just on the realities of life as a professional cyclist, and that it's not all kind of, you know, living the dream and milk and honey. It can be tough, and especially maybe when you live in a place like Girona where you are surrounded, there is no escape, you know, and if things aren't maybe going that well, you know, if you're recovering from a broken collarbone or something, you can't race, that can be quite tough, I would imagine. And I get the sense Hannah's somebody who needs to get out of that bubble now and again, and needs to have other things going on in her life. But very few athletes admit to that.
I think Molly Weaver, actually, I remember when she said that, actually, when she had her crash, was trying to come back from it, and then, you know, her head wasn't in the right place for getting back on the start line. And I remember her saying to me that being in Girona did make that worse, because you know all you can ever see in Girona are other cyclists going out and doing their training, and then it becomes so easy to kind of count the hours that they've been gone and you haven't gone out that day, so you've taken a step back from whatever level they're on. And it's such a strange bubble. I've been a few times, but only on for working, and like, you'll see the same pro cyclist. I remember bumping into Peter Vakoch. I bumped into him three times in one day, and you're like, oh, he might have been stalking us, I don't know.
It's a tiny place, isn't it?
Yeah, but yeah, it is a tiny place.
And you've got that juxtaposition as well with how it comes across on social media. You know, when everybody's taking pictures of their climb of the day or their coffee stop and the sun's shining and it looks beautiful. And the reality of it is, I mean, I think it would be quite horrific actually to live in that echo chamber and that tiny bubble. I don't think it is conducive to very
balanced life.
Yeah, exactly. And good mental health. I think it would be incredibly difficult. So it is refreshing to hear someone like Hannah being quite so open about it. I mean, I'm not saying they have, you know, the hardest of lives, you know, compared to how other people earn their livings, but it's certainly not as rosy and as golden as you might think from afar.
I think the Girona Tourist Board has probably dropped their sponsorship of our program for next time.
I mean, it's funny to think, though. I mean, Lance Armstrong really started the migration to Girona. You know, he went there from Nice back in about, what was it, about 99, 98, around about that, the time he started winning in inverted commas Tour de France. And really, it's become the main hub. And it's not just the professional riders that live there. A lot of amateur riders go there now for cycling holidays. So the streets are really thronged with cyclists, professional and amateur. And that's great as well. I mean, you know, it's wonderful if you are a cyclist, and there's so many bike shops and bike companies around there, and a real great cafe culture as well, which is obviously part of the cycling scene. It's wonderful. There's lots of great things. And we obviously heard from Ashley Moon and Passio in the last episode, and she set up her own centre not far away from there. So there's tons on offer for cyclists. But yeah, if you're maybe going through a tough time, if things aren't going so well, if training isn't going so well, if you are injured, I could imagine it could be quite tough. And like I say, I find it refreshingly honest of Hannah to talk a little bit about that, open up a bit about that.
I think we've got the Girona Tourist Board back on side, Richard.
Yeah, if you're still with us for sponsorship opportunities, please.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the cycling podcast Femina. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com if you enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. That's SISCP25. And we have a question this month for the Science and Sport experts from Georgina Terry. Hello, says Georgina. Thanks for the opportunity to ask Science and Sport about nutrition. I noticed Science and Sports Go Isotonic Energy Gels have far less sugar than some competitors' gels. Please discuss the role of sugar in sports nutrition. A broad but interesting question there from Georgina. Over to you, Ben Samuels.
Thanks for the question, Georgina. So first up, we all know that it's widely accepted that carbohydrate fueled during endurance exercise is required to maintain performance. To then consider the role of sugar in sports nutrition, we need to look at the relationship between carbohydrate ingestion, energy production and exercise performance. It's worth noting first up that the stored form of carbohydrate in the body is liver and muscle glycogen. And alongside blood glucose, that stored glycogen is metabolised for energy production. During exercise, the ingested carbohydrate is digested and converted into glycogen. It's also broken down into glucose and transported to cells within the body. Those two factors in carbohydrate ingestion during exercise result in a potential sparing effect of muscle and liver glycogen and better maintenance of blood glucose levels. All of those things being linked to why we see that performance benefit of carbohydrate feeding in exercise. To achieve all that, the process requires that a carbohydrate source that is easily digested, relatively high GI, and readily available to be metabolised for energy production. Those things can be achieved with the longer chain carbohydrates, not just simple sugars. And that's why you'll see that the Science in Sport Go Isotonic Energy Gel has maltodextrin as its main carbohydrate source and significantly lower simple sugars compared to the others.
Thank you for that, Ben, and thank you to Georgina Terry for the question. If you have a question for the Science of Sport experts, please email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, or send us a message on WhatsApp, a voice memo message. The number is +447971338205, +447971338205. Don't phone the number, but leave a voice memo if you've got a question for the Science of Sport experts. We're going to hear now from a retired Dutch rider you went to see recently, Orla Iris Slappendel, who lives in Rotterdam. I think you went to see her there. Tell us about her, please.
Yeah, Iris, a veteran of women's cycling. She was 15 years in the pro peloton, retired in 2016, former Dutch national champion. She sort of straddled that era, if you like, of dominance between Marianne Vos and pre Anna van der Breggen, Annemiek van Vleuten. And she's been very active in cycling since retiring, one of three founding members of the Cyclist Alliance, which is, I guess, now the Women's Cycling Union. And I wanted to chat to you about a number of things. I mentioned earlier that I spoke to you about Dutch women's dominance, but we're saving that for a bit of a special that we're working on. But she had so much that was interesting to say about a number of different things. Firstly, about the Cyclist Alliance and the work that they're doing. Because, Rose, you pointed out to me when you listened to the interview that we think of the Cyclist Alliance as being quite campaigning and forward-looking, I guess, outward-looking. But actually, the work that they do internally is really interesting. And a lot of the nitty-gritty that they do is very much in the devil of the detail of women's cycling, when they're looking at helping with women's contracts, a number of different things that she mentions that I thought were quite interesting. And also, just before I went to see her, the Dutch newspaper De Volkskrant ran an article which was picked up on by Cycling News, featuring quotes and interviews from a number of former Cervelo Bigler riders. Who came out against the owner, Thomas Campagna, and accused him of abusing his power, of bullying, fat-shaming and intimidating riders. So I asked her a little bit about that. I mean, she didn't want to be drawn on it too much. She didn't want it to become, you know, any kind of a Me Too thing or anything. But it was just interesting how she saw that as being relevant to the wider sport. Because I think that we on the Cycling Podcast Feminine quite rightly like to promote and highlight what has changed for the better in women's cycling. But because of the nature of these kinds of problems, not everyone will be willing to speak out about I hesitate to say any kind of an underbelly in women's cycling. It's the same in all elite sport, really. It's the same in all walks of life where you have power, there will be abuse of power. But we don't necessarily know all the negatives that are happening, but that's what she deals with. So it was interesting to get her take on just exactly what state women's cycling is in from that perspective at the moment. So plenty to chat about with Iris Slappendel, who was wearing a neck brace. She was still recovering from a hiking accident. So typical former riders having an accident there. again in another sport, but she's recovering well and she's in good form. Shall we hear from her?
So I want to ask you a little bit about your work with the Cyclist Alliance and how all of that's going. It seems to be that you have an awful lot of support amongst the female peloton. How do you see the work progressing so far?
Yeah, I'm super positive about it. And it is, I have to say, when we started a year ago, so we do it now for, we're working on it for 1 year, and I totally underestimate the amount of work that comes into it. But it's, I mean, already for a first year, we've achieved so much, and that's really, really motivating. And I mean, we can't speak about everything that we achieved because a lot of stuff just is quite personal. And that was really what we hoped for, the fact that if it's just a small, like helping a rider to compose an email to her team manager, or for us to write to a team manager or to whoever, can already make a big difference. And that's very rewarding. Yeah.
So you mentioned team managers. You were featured in the press recently talking about one of your former team managers, Thomas Campagna, at Cervelo Bigla. And you were joined by fellow teammates talking about, allegations of bullying and of mistreatment, I guess. How widespread do you think the problem of any kind of abuse by team managers is in women's cycling?
I think there are definitely more teams where same things happen, and I know about it. So it's more widespread. And actually, it's not just something that's in women's cycling. It's in men's cycling exactly the same. I think it's actually in every sport where there is, I say, abuse of power. I mean, you're always relying on a team manager to give you a job. And especially in the lower ranked teams, in men or women, that's, I mean, for big riders, for the stars, they can just choose where to go and they get treated well. But I think for the lower ranked riders, this is more of a problem. And you see, yeah, there are more teams where it happens. And I think, first of all, I would say it was not my idea to get this story out. And I think also amongst the peloton, everyone knows about what happened in this team, or is happens, and also in other teams. But through my work with the Cyclist Alliance, I get quite a lot of emails or calls from riders that have similar problems, and they are all so scared to speak out or to go to the UCI or to go to, I don't know, their national safe sport person. So yeah, and that makes me really sad. It makes me sad that riders are so depending on their sport, or they think they are so depending on people in the sport.
So what kinds of things are we talking about then? I mean, I don't want to be sensationalist about it in any way, but I think a lot of people would have been quite surprised by reading the interview with you, because, as you say, riders are scared to speak out. And so if they don't speak out, then us on the outside, and even though we work in cycling, have no idea of what's going on. So what kinds of things? How bad is it?
What we see also with the Cyclist Alliance, there is a lot of things that, you know, you have team managers saying, like, okay, if you there's a lot of times that they say, okay, if you do this or that, then you're not getting raced, or you're getting pulled out of the team, or and that's not, and then I haven't heard of any sexual abuse, for example, thank God. But it's a lot of, like, mental abuse, a lot of stuff with nutrition. Like, there's a lot of pushing riders to become more skinny. And I know, for example, that being skinny is part of our sport. But at the same time, I think, come on, people, hire some professionals to help your athletes to be a healthy athlete, you know, and not just a team manager that says, oh, you are not allowed to eat carbohydrates anymore. You can only drink water on the bike, because that person is a sport director or a team manager. You're not a nutritionist. And you see that also in training or in tactics in the race. But I mean, there's also riders that have to drive like 500 km home after a race, the night after a race, you know. They drive from Belgium to the south of France. when they just raise 140k because there's no money for a hotel. You know, that kind of stuff worries me as well. And when you speak up as a rider, they're like, well, then you don't race next week. It's really all kind of things. And it depends a little bit on the team, and it depends a little bit on the culture. Equipment is also something they say, oh yeah, this rider gets this bike and the other rider gets a more expensive bike. I don't know. It's very it's very based on just emotions or something.
So how much of that just comes with the territory? It's a tough sport. There isn't a lot of money in the sport. And you've said yourself that a lot of your fellow females, for example, and you can only speak for the female peloton, that sometimes when you're riding with them, you think they have to toughen up a little bit.
Yeah.
So how much of it is just unfair and that's life?
There are definitely things that are just, they'd say, okay, that's life. I mean, if you're part of a UCI team, or if you sign a contract, then you also make a commitment. And it's not a vacation, for sure. Yeah. And sometimes riders come to me and they say like, oh, my team manager asked me to go to this race or this race. Well, and then I also say like, well, you're part of a team. You signed this contract. So you have to go to that race. I mean, it's also, when you're working, you also can't say on Monday, oh, I don't feel like working today. So definitely, sometimes I speak to riders and I say, well, this is part of your job, so just do it. It's not all fun. But there's also things that are just purely intimidation, and that should not be. And there's also quite a lot of very unprofessional people in the sport that I just think, why are you in a sport? Are you just here to, because you enjoy making riders, putting pressure on them or make them scared? So it's, yeah, well, we see both, and we're always honest with the riders, and sometimes we choose not the side that they would love to hear. So yeah, and I think that's what we see most. Yeah.
So if the riders can't or won't speak out, what can be done about genuine cases of intimidation or bullying, for example? How can it change?
It can't. I think you have to speak out. You don't have to go to media. I think that's not the thing you actually should do. At least not the first thing you should do. I think you should go to the ethics commission of the UCI, or you should go to your own national safe sport, or you go to us and we help you maybe to mediate or to speak with the person you have the problem with. So I think that are the best ways to change it. But and sometimes that's not enough. And I mean, also with the ethics commission, yeah, what's really ethics, huh? So for example, we also advised, because we keep, although I don't have the best experience with the ethics commission, we keep advising riders to go to the ethics commission. But the UCI somehow doesn't really seem like a safe place for them to go. And although the ethics commission is independent, and secondly, some happens then when they go to the ethics commission, they find the allegations
dismissed.
Something we did as the Cyclist Alliance is we did a team culture survey the past year. So we asked all the riders really about team culture, actually. So about if they get paid, if team managers keep their promises, if they do get the equipment, how transport is to races, how is the logistics arranged. So all these things that, because almost every team offers the same contract, and yes, you get more money here and there, but it's the most important is that you feel happy and safe in a team. And that's apparently something riders are not so don't feel so free to talk about, even within teams or amongst each other. So that's why the survey really helped, so that riders can call us or email us, and we haven't made this information public, but they could say, okay, Iris, I'm in doubt between choosing team A or B for next year. Can you tell me a little bit more about that team? And then I can say, well, in team A, The riders rank this, rank the equipment really high, but they rank logistics very low. And these are things that some riders have said, and so maybe that's something you can keep in mind with making your decision. And I know, of course, it's very... It's not very objective, but it's, I think it's a start, and it can help making a decision. And the same counts for the mentor program we have. So we connect a young rider with an experienced rider, because that from a different team, because that experienced rider has a lot of experience and they know a lot what happens in the world of women cycling. So they can coach the young rider as well with making this kind of decisions. And it's not just about picking teams, it's also about becoming a professional, and there's no school to become a professional. So I mean, I think a mentoring program is really, really valuable. But I think it all comes back to opening up about this kind of things. And that doesn't have to be in public, but just speak about it amongst your peers, yeah.
Are you encouraged by the professionalisation, the increased professionalisation of women cycling? I'm thinking of the recent announcements by the UCI in terms of a minimum salary and stricter contracts, but also the likes of Trek Segafredo coming in and having former riders as DSs. You know, we're talking about a culture whereby some team managers maybe shouldn't be in the sport, but we're bringing people through the sport who have hopefully its best interest at heart. Are you encouraged for the future of women's cycling in those respects?
Yeah, I'm very encouraged, and I'm also really, really positive. And I'm first of all, I'm really happy that the UCI implemented these new regulations. And I know it's going to be scary, and I know it's going to be problems for teams or whatever, but we have to start somewhere. And I think it already took way too long. And I'm also very encouraged that the fact that UCI now also listens to the rider and riders, and we were involved in this process. So yes, I think it's very important, and not just the minimum salary actually doesn't interest me so much, but I think it's way more the extra regulations on team staff and the improved ethics code and the maternity leave. You know, it's all these things that make it possible to really make a healthy career. And yes, of course, I mean, the teams are really stepping up, and I think the same as you say, it's harder for a young rider to come into elite level. Maybe within teams we also get more of a bigger disparity between the lower ranked teams and teams like Trek, for example. But at the same time, that should not be a reason to not become more professional. I mean, that's the evolution of the sport, and maybe it will be a little bit strange years now to get this trend. I see it a little bit like a transfer period maybe, and I'm super stoked to see people like Bronzini staying in the sport, and Ina Joke Teutenberg to be back at on this level. And you know, for us as a Cyclist Alliance, Trek Segafredo, they contact us some time before they make the announcement. So this is also a team that I really feel have the best interest for the riders, and they want to work together with us. And there are more teams actually that want to work with us. So for me, for us, I should say, I think teams shouldn't see the Cyclist Alliance as a threat. I mean, we all have the same interest to make our sport better and to have more media coverage. And I mean, if the sport grows, if teams grow, then riders will benefit from it.
So Iris Slappendal there, I mean, interesting, because she seemed to be one of the main voices in the case against Thomas Campagna. She rode for Svelo Bigla for a year, and a few other ex-riders backed up what she'd said, including Annemiek van Vleuten came out in support as well. And in fact, Slappendal put together a big dossier of, you know, some of the evidence that she gathered about Campagna's behaviour. One of the other more recent high profile riders on that team, Ashley Mulman Passio, who we featured in the last episode, the interview was carried out before this story came out. She was reluctant to be drawn on the story. She didn't want to add her voice to it at all. You know, and the team goes into the season, I gather, with a new charter about, you know, how people are treated on the team. Thomas Campagna is still in charge. The team leader now, Cecilia Utrip Ludwig, in the, you know, with Ashley Mumapasio moving on. It was a pretty disturbing story, but she broadened it out there in your interview, Orla, you know, to being more about some of the issues that writers contend with as a consequence of the lack of resources in women's professional cycling. You know, writers having to, you know, being put in situations which are perhaps not healthy and perhaps dangerous, having to drive, for example, you know, hundreds of kilometres because the team hasn't put you up in a hotel. And I guess these are things we don't maybe think about too much, but are inevitable if, you know, budgets are low and writers can't, you know, we heard in the part two with Hannah Barnes just comparing the support she gets on one of the biggest teams in women's cycling with her boyfriend, Theo Gegenhardt, Team Sky. And as it trickles down, more and more writers will be having to make compromises like that, where they are perhaps putting themselves in less than optimal situations.
I think that's where the Cyclist Alliance is wonderful, because a lot of women's cycling is still run by men, essentially, who will not have played a big part in women's cycling. You know, if you look at the top of the UCI, you don't have an awful lot. You've got the Athletes Commission and whatnot, and it's becoming stronger. But I think the Cyclist Alliance is brilliant because you do have riders and former riders with their experience and firsthand knowledge of what the issues actually are. And then they will have the trust of the riders as well. And that's what you need, really, for any sport to become stronger and become more professional. It needs to be changed from within and by people who have that kind of standing. So it's brilliant that the likes of Iris is happy to use her position within professional women's cycling to try to make it better for future riders.
I mean, that's what I thought was one of the things I thought that was so interesting about what Iris was saying was about doing the survey about team cultures and having that information to pass on to riders who are making career changes or, you know, wanting to change teams. They can get that information and then get quite a full picture of what the culture is like on that team, whether it suits them or whether it doesn't. I mean, there's a lot of victim shaming, a big victim shaming culture in society, and I imagine some riders go to teams, they'll take up opportunities and they end up in these like dangerous or unhealthy situations, and people say, well, you know, how did you not know that was how this team runs? You know, how can you not be aware of that? But I think what Iris is doing, what the union is doing, is enabling people to make empowered decisions by giving them the information they need to make those choices.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on the story as it relates to Thomas Campagna and the allegations that were made against him, and you know, speak to him as soon as we see him at a race this year, because he will be running the Bigla team again in 2019. It's his team. We should wrap things up for this month, folks, because Orla, you've got a lot to fit in before
fit
your
out.
Date with Destiny tomorrow.
Your time's at a bit of a push.
Oh, very good. Very
well, but no, but best of luck, Orla. By the time
this
comes out, Shinui Jr. will be at large.
Oh,
so
God.
To speak.
Yeah, and it is quite large. Yeah.
Oof.
You'll be much diminished.
Slightly less large. Yeah.
But you know, good luck with that. And I know that you'll already be turning your thoughts next week to next month's episode
of
the Cycling Podcast Femina.
Of course. Well, I've already been lining stuff up for next
month.
What
do we have
episode?
Lined up for next month, folks?
Well, I have set up for you like a bit of a blind date to go and chat to Danny Rowe. I've been masterminding that from afar.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, you're going to chat to her, though, aren't you, about retirement and her plans for life after professional cycling, which should be good. I mean, and also, I guess, about her whole experience within British cycling.
Yep, and a couple of other things we might do next month. Maybe take a little look at cyclocross, and maybe ask Julia Elliott to join us. Who that's been promised, isn't it? Julia Elliott, kind of all round cyclist.
You've been
have you got a leather jacket?
Cool, all round cool cat.
Have you got one though, or do you have to buy one?
Me,
because the thing about leather jackets, what, you can't wear it fresh.
I've forgotten what the leather jacket reference is. Sorry.
That was you trying to...
You're trying to be cool.
Oh, yeah.
Cool yourself up.
Like Tucker Jenkins from Grange Hill.
I remember, don't get that.
Oh, you're too young, Rose, to remember Tucker Jenkins. He had a leather jacket.
Buy
he looked really cool.
Hand, that's my advice. If you didn't I'm going to look him ready, up.
I don't have a leather jacket. I'm not getting a leather jacket. I think as long
wasn't
as
it
I...
Also a little earring, wasn't it? Which he might have. Richard's wearing headphones, so I can't see.
I think as long as I'm freshly shaved with my Harry's razor, I'll be...
You're just cool enough the way you are.
Just cool, sure. Just cool enough is just about right. Thank you, Orla. Well, listen...
I didn't mean just. I meant, I'm trying to wrap, I meant yours.
Trying to wrap things Sorry. Up here. Trying to let you go. Thanks very much for joining us from our Amsterdam studio, Orla.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Val.
We'll see you next month. Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.